and it is 10 a.m. in the West Coast, it is 1 p.m. in the East Coast, and it's 8 p.m. in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Today is January 25th, 2016, and this is Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Today on BBS Radio, we are going to send our warmest regards to everybody that is under the weather, and hoping that you all are safe and warm, and I hope that somebody is taking care of you. I want to send my special prayer for the old folks, to the one that have so hard time to get warm, and I pray to God that it will keep everybody safe. It's not easy. Everybody is suffering right now from the weather, and we all have to get together and just get over this time. And, you know, today is January 25th, and I know that the talks in Syria were supposed to start, the peace talk, the one where they stop the war and they stop the killing, they stop all the bombing and people devastation over the land of Syria, and start negotiating a peace deal. They had to come up with a good bunch of people to talk. And for some reason, they couldn't agree who in the opposition will come and talk. And it's understood that there are so many people who want to be part of the solution. But that's a big problem when we don't have enough people helping them. You see, that's a part of the devastation of this area in the Middle East, that many people are trying so hard. They got the spirit, they got the heart, but they cannot manage themselves, the time, and the one that, you know, to coordinate efforts. So it's not that they're not smart. They're smart, and they'll, you know, they can do anything if they want, but we need, they need to trust somebody. So we need to trust this party to come across as honest broker. And, you know, when American and the Russians are in play, and we know Iran and the Saudis are in play, and they are not a part of the solution, they're not supposed to sit on the negotiation table, that's great, you know, the Saudis and the Iranian intent. That's great, a little problem, because you don't see the support. So I hope, I really hope that the next few days we're going to have the talk start again, and let's listen to what we have on Syria today.
The latest round of Syria peace talks, scheduled to begin today in Geneva, have been delayed. The Kremlin-backed Syrian government blamed the opposition delegation for failing to decide who should be sent to the negotiations. Politicians in the Middle East and the European Union have long sought to solve political differences in Syria. They believe the best way to solve such differences are through peace talks.
And that is that. Peace talk, yes. But just give them a plan of action. Tell them we're going to meet in this room, we're going to talk about this issue, we're going to be composed of those people, divide them by task. Why don't you guys do that? You know, of course, I'm a dog girl sometimes when I explain this. I just want to tell you, whatever we understand in the free world, whatever America understands, it's not a given in the Middle East, because the education system is different, the way they perceive stuff is different, and it's about time we start being enlightened and start coming across with some plan. So we divide them by issues, we divide the group by people that can respond, location, geographic issue, create table, create a plan, ask the question, and that's all. And let's go to work. It's not the negotiation, violent negotiation, it's a team that needs to create the zone. People are dying, people are killed, people are starving. There must be a solution. It's about time the world get up and snap out, you know, from the dormant stage that they are and move along. You know, we cannot allow it to continue anymore, not in this era. We're a globalized economy here where you have all on the internet. You can order support. You can tell what you need. Everything is monitored and we can get help and nobody should use force. And I know that we're supposed to defeat ISIS and they have to come and turn around and change because they're acting like guerrillas and we don't know who they are. But, all right, it's not easy. It's not easy. Nobody said it's easy. But we need to start with something. All right, and in midst of this, we have President Rouhani that started his first tour in the region after the sanction being lifted off Iran. Remember, Iran just finished many years of sanction where she threatened the rest of the free world with nuclear, you know, capability or intention. And once she does that, she endangers many people. Let's listen to that.
First, I've repeatedly voiced Russia's official stance. Iran has the right to a peaceful nuclear program, and it can't be singled out for discrimination. Second, we need to be aware that Iran is located in a very challenging region. I've told our Iranian partners about that. That's why Iranian threats made towards neighboring countries, in particular Israel, threats that Israel can be destroyed, are absolutely unacceptable. This is counterproductive.
This is not a proper quote of the Iranian president.
It doesn't quite matter whether it's a proper quote or not. It means it's best to avoid a wording that could be improperly quoted or could be interpreted differently. That's why the focus on Iran does have a reason behind it. I have no doubts that Iran is compliant with the rules, simply because there's no proof of the opposite. According to the latest IAEA report, Iran has been abiding by the commitments it has taken up. True, there are some outstanding issues, but with due patience and friendly attitudes, they can be resolved. I have a great respect for Iran and a great interest in it. This is a great country indeed. You don't often hear this attitude mentioned in relation to Iran, but it's true. This is a country with a great culture, a great history, and is a great nation. They're very proud of their country. They have their own understanding of their place, both in the region and in the world, and that's something you have to respect. You've grasped the core of the problem. Iranians are very smart and cunning politicians. And to a certain degree, they have exploited this confrontation with the United States.
They are not the only ones.
They're extremely crafty in this, and they do it to tackle their domestic political issues. When there's an external enemy, it united the nation. But I guess the United States have been employing the same technique. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, there have been no external threats that would allow Washington to dominate the West. There must be a threat so that the US can protect their allies from it. This position yields political and economic benefits. If everyone relies on one country for protection, then this country is entitled to some preferential treatment. So it's very important to possess this status of a global defender, to be able to resolve issues even beyond the realm of foreign policy and security issues. I think the US has been using Iran for this very purpose, that it is to unite their allies in the shadow of a real or false threat. It's quite a complicated issue, but it's not an issue for Russia. We've been complying with our international commitments, including on Iran's peaceful nuclear program. As you know, Russia built the Bushehr power plant in Iran. We've completed this project and are prepared for further cooperation. Yet when we proposed to enrich uranium on Russian territory, our Iranian partners refused, for reasons unknown to us. They argue that they will enrich uranium on their own, in line with existing international regulations. And as I said earlier, if they don't break any rules, they're fully entitled to do that. We will endorse this right, but we will also remain aware of the concerns that other states and the international community has concerning full compliance with these rules.
Can I clarify something? The thing is, I was asking you not only about the U.S.-Iranian relations, but also about the U.S.-Russian relations. Would you agree that we have fundamental ideological differences on key issues of international law?
So right on the eve of my meeting with Barack Obama, you're pushing me to make some serious statements.
It's a very important issue. If the country thinks it has more rights than others...
I thought you wouldn't notice my deviation, but you did. Indeed, you are very persistent. To date, we don't have any significant ideological differences, but we have fundamental cultural differences. Individualism lies at the core of the American identity, while Russia has been a country of collectivism. One student of Pushkin's legacy has formulated this difference very aptly. Take Scarlett O'Hara from Gone with the Wind, for instance. She says, "I'll never be hungry again." This is the most important thing for her. Russians have different, far loftier ambitions, more of a spiritual kind. It's more about your relationship with God. We have different visions of life. That's why it's very difficult to understand each other, but it's still possible.
But that's why there's international law to create a level playing field for everyone.
The US is a very democratic state, there's no doubt about that, and it originally developed as a democratic state. When the first settlers set their foot on the continent, life forced them to forge a relationship and maintain a dialogue with each other to survive. That's why America was initially conceived as a fundamental democracy. With that in mind, we should not forget that America's development began with a large-scale ethnic cleansing, unprecedented in human history. I wouldn't like to delve so deeply into it, but you're forcing me to do it. When Europeans arrived in America, that was the first thing they did. And you have to be honest about it. There are not so many stories like that in human history. Take the destruction of Carthage by the Roman Empire. The legend has it that Romans plowed over and sowed the city with salt so that nothing will ever grow there. Europeans didn't use the salt because they used the land for agriculture, but they wiped out the indigenous population. Then there was slavery, and that's something that's deeply ingrained in America. In his memoirs, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell revealed how hard it was for him as a black man, how hard it was for him to live with other people staring at you. It means this mentality has taken root in the hearts and minds of the people and is likely to still be there. Now take the Soviet Union. We know a lot about Stalin now. We know him as a dictator and a tyrant. But still, I don't think that in the spring of 1945, Stalin would have used a nuclear bomb against Germany, if he had one. He could have done it in 1941 or 1942, when it was a matter of life or death. But I really doubt that he would have done it in 1945, when the enemy had almost given up and had absolutely no chance to reverse the trend. I don't think he would. Now look at the US, they dropped the bomb on Japan, a country that was a non-nuclear state and was very close to defeat. So there are big differences between us, but it's quite natural that people with such differences are determined to find ways to understand each other better. I don't think there is an alternative. Moreover, it's not by chance that Russia and the US forged an alliance in the most critical moments of modern history. That was the case in World War I and World War II. Even if there was fierce confrontation, our countries united in the face of a common threat, which means there's something that unites us. There must be some fundamental interest that brings us together. That's something we need to focus on first. We need to be aware of our differences, but focus on a positive agenda that can improve our cooperation.
America and Russia's relations with the U.S. are important issues for our network, largely because Americans make up...
Wow, that was great. That was Russian talking about American. That was President Putin speaking about the possibility of re-engaging and talking about, with America about solving the situation in the global era. I think that I mentioned it before. I think that I listened to it before. And I still think that it's honest call to collaborate and help around to come to a solution, especially when the crisis. And as you said, the Second World War, we had American helping and solving the situation together with Russia. And now this is it. And today I had a call from a very nice lady. She's a journalist from Al Jazeera. you know, Al Jazeera from all thing is Arabic Muslim. And as you know, I'm a really, really Jewish and very Israeli, American, of course, but very Israeli too. And I was so happy to hear it because it means that we're talking. We are talking to each other. And her name is Megan O'Toole, and she was lovely. And she asked me a question about the situation on Temple Mount. And for anyone who knows my relation with God, you know I'm very close. I love God, and I think that we need to give God the space. And we need to stop being with our ego, the phenomena of the world. Let God be it. And we spoke, and I said, you know, we ride this world onto a cliff. Right now, we have one solution only, to turn around and see what we can do to work things over. Because everybody can jump out of the cliff. To do the right thing, we need women. And, you know, there are many women that are capable to do. I'm not talking about the American presidential race, please, because after this new movie of 13 Hours that is just came out, I don't think Hillary stands a chance. So let's listen to what 13 Hours is about.
Libyan visa. Official.
Pull over for inspection.
Sorry, sir, I can't do that.
Pull over for inspection!
How willing are you to die for your country? I'm ready to go right here, right now.
Hey everybody, this is Jack Silva.
Jack.
We trained SEALs at Coronado, so he knows the drill.
Welcome to Club Med.
We need immediate assistance. We are overrun.
State's under attack. Let's go, man. State's under attack.
Let's go. We gotta move.
If you do not get here soon, we're all gonna die.
You have a U.S. ambassador at risk.
The ambassador is in his safe haven. You're not the first responders. You're the last resort. You will wait.
None of you have to go. But we are the only help they have.
Wow, listen, it's really hard to listen to it over the radio when there are visuals and it takes, you know, half out of the act. 13 Hours, the new movie is about the Benghazi situation, the Benghazi stand-up that American ambassador had to endure and die with an attack on the embassy. It wasn't easy to listen to it. It wasn't easy for the Marines that had to fight the commander to be in the game. And as we all know, the situation got out of hand. And, of course, we lost dear four American heroes. It's not easy to chew it again, but the people need to know. And since it was a question of decision making, it's in the air. And the idea about war and the idea about conflict is not simple. not everybody see eye to eye, but there are some rules of conduct that people do and expect, especially in the region, in the Middle East. So the idea was that that they were supposed to help, the Marine was supposed to launch, you know, to defend the ambassador, but they were told to stand down. So who knows? God knows what was in stake. I cannot judge. I don't have I'm not inclined, and I don't want to even stand for a minute there thinking what can be done in this situation. We're just going to pray for those souls, and we're just going to pray that this will go away in the memory, in the history book, as a lesson learned and a sacrifice that was made for liberty. And the lesson that we all take from there is that we need to have a plan, something that we lack sometimes, even though that it's so simple. And, you know, whoever is in America, they know that you have to make plan A, plan B, plan C, and you think things over and you write it down and you chat. So in the security forces, they have so many plans. I don't know what was there. Anyway, let's keep on going, because today is Tu B'Shvat in Israel. Tu B'Shvat is the holiday of the trees. And I picked a sweet song for you on the trees, just to symbolize the nature, because today is the startup of, the first glimpse of spring will start. Forever, whoever is in the snow, you don't believe me. Yeah, but the sun will come soon, so God is here. Don't worry, it's going to be okay. So let's listen to the tree song, Sweet Little, for the kids in the audience. God bless you all. I love you.
I saw a tree by a river side one day as I walked along, straight as an arrow and pointing to the sky, growing tall and strong.
All right. It's a sweet song about trees, and something that I learned recently, you know, speaking different languages, you have association of different things. And in Hebrew, when you talk about liberty, you talk about atzmaut, it's liberty. And one of the things, one of the words that are a part of liberty is a tree, in Hebrew, of course. So when you think about being free, you have to understand that you have to have really, really strong roots, and you have to have a really, really high, tall understanding and vision far away. Once you start having this liberty of being, of existing, when you know that you can go wherever you want, and the sky is the limit, of course, you will have the freedom to continue. And that's why you need to know where you're coming and where you're going. And every time we forget that, and many people and many children, young people, forget. And we need to remind them sometimes. And let's remind some young people about what is in stake and something that nobody mentioned to them. Let's listen to Bernie Sanders, the old fox, but he actually appealed to the youngsters. Let's listen to him.
Hey world, Dan Brown here. We are 300 days away from the 2016 U.S. presidential election, but more importantly, at this juncture anyway, we are 19 days away from the Iowa caucuses. And the big story for Democrats anyway is Bernie Sanders' surge in the polls.
The bigger surprise right here, Sanders closing in on Hillary Clinton in the Hawkeye state, and that has her campaign admitting they are nervous.
A whole bevy of polls were released yesterday, and some even show Sanders ahead of Clinton in Iowa. Any way you slice it, though, the general trend is clear. And it's not just in Iowa, where Sanders, of course, has been campaigning heavily. No, it's nationwide. Investor's Business Daily is the first pollster to show that now that people are paying serious attention, because, like, it's 2016, Bernie Sanders has all of the momentum. This is the first nationwide poll to show him within the margin of error of Hillary Clinton ever. And it doesn't stop there. Just today, Bernie won a huge endorsement from MoveOn.org and received some very public high praise from our very popular vice president.
Bernie is speaking to a yearning that is deep and real, and he has credibility on it. Hillary's focus has been on other things up to now, and that's been Bernie's. No one questions Bernie's authenticity on those issues.
Now, the extent of Sanders' jump here is impressive, but what with the media's, you know, Trump tunnel vision, many voters are just now learning that, I mean, one, Sanders exists, but two, moreover, he's viable, right? It shouldn't be a surprise that he's gaining generally. I would guess that the Clinton campaign has been preparing for this day for a while, but that they've had to pull the trigger on this messaging a little sooner than expected.
They're back. Awkward, even dangerous. So ask yourself, who's the one candidate who can stop them? Hillary Clinton.
It's not a direct attack on Bernie per se, but the idea is pretty clear, right? I can win in a general election and Bernie can't, so vote for me. Bernie is not taking this one sitting down, though, and is firing back on the campaign trail.
In New Hampshire, according to this poll, we beat Trump by 20 points. Clinton beats him by 14 points. Republicans win elections when people are demoralized, when they give up on the political process, and when they don't vote. In terms of bringing young people and working class people into the political process, any objective assessment will suggest that our campaign has a lot more momentum and a lot more energy than Secretary Clinton's campaign.
We have a few weeks yet before people start voting, so, you know, we'll keep a keen eye out and I'll keep you posted here. But at this point, what do you think? Will Bernie's momentum carry him to victory in Iowa and New Hampshire? Or will Hillary Clinton stop the bleeding before it turns into outright hemorrhaging? It's a little graphic, I guess. Leave a comment below or upload a video response. As for the Republicans, Pogo Triber Ryan, speaking of video responses, had some thoughts on my thoughts from last week.
My grandfather is very involved in the political process and is very conservative. He believes that eventually Cruz will overtake Trump. Most Trump supporters are either very old conservatives or very young conservatives. Eventually, all of the 26 to 50-year-olds will come into the political process and then they'll influence their children and then they will eventually turn away from Trump and that will lead to his downfall.
Thank you, Ryan. You know, you may be right. I was reading some analysis yesterday that suggests the window for a, quote, establishment candidate to emerge is closing, and the more time passes, the more this is shaping up to be a Cruz versus Trump ordeal. The article does float one name, however, that has flown under the radar pretty much so far, and that is John Kasich, the current governor of Ohio, who's bouncing in the polls a little bit. Some recent polls have shown Kasich passing Marco Rubio for second place in New Hampshire, and if that holds on primary day, it could vault Kasich into first place among so-called establishment Republicans. But that there is so much confusion as to who the establishment will ultimately rally around indicates that by the time they actually choose somebody, it could very well be too little too late. After letting this percolate through the synapses a little, I'm inclined to change my prediction. I'm not as convinced as you are, Ryan, that Trump's position is particularly weak. I mean, he just keeps going up and up and up in the polls. The idea that he's not going to win appears more and more to me like wishful thinking. I think that Donald Trump will probably win the Republican nomination, but that he's liable to pick Ted Cruz as his running mate. And, you know, while we're making Hail Mary predictions, why not just call the whole general election matchup, okay? It's going to be Trump, Cruz versus Sanders, Warren. What a time to be alive. These are just my thoughts, of course. I definitely want to know yours. Leave a comment below, or even better, upload a video response and email a link to Dan Brown Universe.
All right. What a trooper. Yes, that seems like there is a shuffle in the mix, and something that I know that Bernie Sanders attract a lot of youngsters for some reason is talking their language, he understands what they need, and they have his back. They love him, and it's not like in the past. This guy is a true leader. He understands people. He's been around for a while. Nobody pay attention to him, so pay attention. But something that is interesting, that there are all those famous people that support Bernie Sanders right now, and while one of the youngsters were listing all those who's, you know, who's and who's are on the list of supporter of Sanders, he mentioned Neil Young, and he said, I don't know who this guy is, but I guess that he was a folklore singer. So for whoever doesn't know who Neil Young, yeah, and you want to lead the country, you know, to support the leader of the future of the world, you need to know who is Neil Young. So I brought this to you. All right. That was Neil Young, somebody that I listened to him when I was young, and he gives you really great melody, great words, and inspiration, and he's calm, and he's smooth. My goodness, many years ago, that was, you know, the deal. In the radio station, I remember, in Rome, that's the music that we play all the time. Now, let's go back to our life. We have a controversial issue that is still bouncing back and forth, and it's about Ted Cruz's eligibility to be a president because he was born on Canada soil. And the question was, is he a natural birth, you know, by birth American? Now, sometimes you need to get an example from elsewhere to understand if you're in the right direction and if you know the truth. So the question is, if Ted Cruz is a natural born American? So I'll tell you what's the story about being an Israeli, okay? Comparison, but it's the solution is there. When Israeli live outside of the country, they have children. Well, immediately when the children turn 18, the children that were born in America, they were born in Canada, born elsewhere, they never been to Israel. When they come to Israel, they are supposed to serve in the military. The Israeli government don't care if you've been in Timbuktu or whatever. You are Israeli, right? So the same token is for everyone. If your mother is American and you were born in Canada, in Colombia, wherever, you're still an American. You're obligated, you have the responsibility, you have the right to vote, and you are the passport, and you are naturally by birth an American. So you are born to be American citizen. You didn't become so by entitlement, he has the right to do so. That's my view. That's the view of the Constitution, they say. And since they didn't specify that only by birth alone, you know, like you're born on the land, I guess Donald Trump does not have a case. But we have somebody to explain it to you. Let's listen to that.
I want to throw this issue out there. Ready for this one? Here it comes. You know Ted Cruz, Mr. Producer? You've heard of that name? A senator from Texas? He's an American citizen. A naturalized American citizen. He can run for president of the United States. Oh, it's true. It's true. Here's the Cato Institute of all places, libertarian think tank, Ilya Shapiro. As we head into a potential government shutdown over the funding of Obamacare, the iconoclastic junior senator from Texas continues to stride across the national stage. And with his presidential aspirations as big as everything in his home state, writes this writer, by now many know what has never been a secret. Ted Cruz was born in Canada. Oh my God! But does that mean that Cruz's presidential ambitions are gummed up with marble syrup or stuck in snowdrifts, altogether different from those plaguing the Iowa caucuses? Are the birthers now hoist on their own petards, having been unable to find any proof that Obama was born outside the by forcing their comrade in boots to disqualify himself by releasing his Alberta birth certificate? No, actually, it's not even that complicated. You just have to look up the right law. It boils down to whether Cruz is a natural-born citizen, quote-unquote, of the United States, the only class of people constitutionally eligible for the presidency. You see, the Founding Fathers didn't want their newly independent nation to be taken over by foreigners on the sly. So what's a natural-born citizen? Well, may I add this? It's not in the column. It seems like every jerk with access to Google has decided what a natural-born citizen is. And they insist that everybody agree with them. But the Constitution doesn't say. But the framers' understanding, combined with statutes enacted by the first Congress, indicate that the phrase means both birth abroad to American parents in a matter regulated by federal law and birth within the nation's territory, regardless of parental citizenship. The Supreme Court has confirmed that definition on multiple occasions in various contexts. Oh, my God! It's true. Wait a minute. We have a meeting scheduled in my mother's basement to go over this. And we're gonna post a lot of comments on the Mark Levin social sites. Let me continue.
Let's go back. I guess we are back, and this is Orly Benny Davis with the Impossible Truth. Listening to many people, I try to encompass as much opinion that I can because I love it. I think that everybody is worth listening to, and everybody is smart enough to talk about issues, so why not? Now, Jack Welch says that Ted Cruz does what he says he's going to do. And, you know, I witnessed Ted Cruz many times, and he's fantastic. And Charlie Condon, the former Attorney General of great state of South Carolina, is actually a former candidate of U.S. Senate that we worked together on the race in the U.S. Senate. He's actually endorsing in some sort Ted Cruz when he says what he says he's going to do. We need a consistent and proven conservative in the White House. Oh, yes, we do. Now, we need somebody who can hold still and think it through like Ted Cruz did on the House floor in 2013. I was there. I was listening. He never missed a beat. They kept him going when he was talking against the healthcare system. But whatever it is, he did it with a gentle voice. Well, he has a great voice. And with a posturing, and he has friends that rally around him to help him. So he can participate. He's a team player. I think that Ted Cruz is becoming to be a very, very likable guy. All right? So let's listen to another song of Neil Young.
When I sing about love and war, I don't really know what I'm saying. I've been in love and I've seen a lot of war. Seen a lot of people praying. They pray to Allen, they pray to the Lord, and mostly they pray about love and war.
All right, and we are back. This was Neil Young, Love and War. It's terrific, don't you think? Anyway, let's listen to, we have a few minutes left, and we can listen to one more segment. Let's listen to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just gave a long answer, Madam Secretary, to Ms. Sanchez about what you heard that night, what you're doing, but nowhere in there did you mention a video. You didn't mention a video because there was never a video-inspired protest in Benghazi. There was in Cairo, but not in Benghazi. Victoria Nuland, your spokesperson at the State Department, hours after the attack said this: Benghazi has been attacked by militants. In Cairo, police have removed demonstrators. Benghazi, you got weapons and explosions. Cairo, you got spray paint and rocks. 1 hour before the attack in Benghazi, Chris Stevens walks the diplomat to the front gate. The ambassador didn't report a demonstration. He didn't report it because it never happened. An eyewitness in the command center that night on the ground said no protest, no demonstration. Two intelligence reports that day: no protest, no demonstration. The attack starts at 3:42 Eastern time, ends at approximately 11:40 p.m. that night. At 4:06, an ops alert goes out across the State Department. It says this: mission under attack, armed men, shots fired, explosions heard. No mention of a video, no mention of a protest, no mention of a demonstration. But the best evidence is Greg Hicks, the number two guy in Libya, the guy who worked side by side with Ambassador Stevens. He was asked, if there had been a protest, would the ambassador have reported it? Mr. Hicks' response: absolutely. For there to have been a demonstration on Chris Stevens' front door and him not to have reported it is unbelievable, Mr. Hicks said. He said, secondly, if it had been reported, he would have been out the back door within minutes. And there was a back gate. Everything points to a terrorist attack. We just heard from Mr. Pompeo about the long history of terrorist incidents, terrorist violence in the country. And yet, 5 days later, Susan Rice goes on 5 TV shows, and she says this: Benghazi was a spontaneous reaction as a consequence of a video. A statement we all know is false. But don't take my word for it. Here's what others have said. Rice was off the reservation on 5 networks, White House worried about the politics. Republicans didn't make those statements. They were made by the people who work for you in the Near Eastern Affairs Bureau, the actual experts on Libya in the State Department. So, if there's no evidence for a video-inspired protest, then where'd the false narrative start? It started with you, Madam Secretary. At 10:08, on the night of the attack, you released this statement: some have sought to justify the vicious behavior as a response to inflammatory material posted on the internet. At 10:08, with no evidence, at 10:08, before the attack is over, at 10:08, when Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty are still on the roof of the annex fighting for their lives, the official statement of the State Department blames a video. Why?
During the day on September 11th, as you did mention, Congressman, there was a very large protest against our embassy in Cairo. Protesters breached the walls. They tore down the American flag. And it was of grave concern to us because the inflammatory video had been shown on Egyptian television, which has a broader reach than just inside Egypt. And if you look at what I said, I referred to the video that night in a very specific way. I said, some have sought to justify the attack because of the video. I used those words deliberately, not to ascribe a motive to every attacker, but as a warning to those across the region that there was no justification for further attacks. And in fact, during the course of that week, we had many attacks that were all about the video. We had people breaching the walls of our embassies in Tunis and Khartoum. We had people, thankfully not Americans, dying at protests, but that's what was going on, Congressman.
Secretary Clinton, I appreciate most of those attacks were after the attack on the facility in Benghazi. You mentioned Cairo. It was interesting what else Ms. Newland said that day. She said, if pressed by the press, if there's a connection between Cairo and Benghazi, she said this, there's no connection between the two. So here's what troubles me. Your experts knew the truth. Your spokesperson knew the truth. Greg Hicks knew the truth. But what troubles me more is I think you knew the truth. I want to show you a few things here. You're looking at an email you sent to your family. Here's what you said. At 11 o'clock that night, approximately 1 hour after you told the American people it was a video, you say to your family, two officers were killed today in Benghazi by an al-Qaeda-like group. You tell the American people one thing, you tell your family an entirely different story. Also, on the night of the attack, you had a call with the president of Libya. Here's what you said to him. Ansar al-Sharia is claiming responsibility. It's interesting, Mr. Katala, one of the guys arrested and charged, actually belonged to that group. And finally, and most significantly, the next day, within 24 hours, you had a conversation with the Egyptian prime minister. You told him this: we know the attack in Libya had nothing to do with the film. It was a planned attack, not a protest. Let me read that one more time. We know, not we think, not it might be, we know the attack in Libya had nothing to do with the film. It was a planned attack, not a protest. State Department experts knew the truth. You knew the truth. But that's not what the American people got. And again, the American people want to know why. Why didn't you tell the American people exactly what you told the Egyptian prime minister?
Well, I think if you look at the statement that I made, I clearly said that it was an attack, and I also said that there were some who tried to justify
it on the basis
of the video, Congressman. And
Real quick, calling it an attack is like saying the sky's blue. Of course it was an attack.
Well,
you know, we want to know the truth. The statement you sent out was a statement on Benghazi, and you say vicious behavior as a response to inflammatory material on the internet. If that's not pointing as the motive of being a video, I don't know what is. And that's certainly how the American people saw it.
Well, Congressman, there was a lot of conflicting information that we were trying to make sense of. The situation was very fluid. It was fast moving. There was also a claim of responsibility by Ansar al-Sharia. And when I talked to the Egyptian prime minister, I said that this was a claim of responsibility by Ansar al-Sharia, by a group that was affiliated or at least wanted to be affiliated with al-Qaeda. Sometime after that, the next day, early the next morning after that, on the 12th or 13th, they retracted their claim of responsibility.
Madam Secretary.
And I think if you look at what all of us were trying to do, and we were in a position, Congressman, of trying to make sense of a lot of incoming information and watch the way the intelligence community tried to make sense of it.
Madam Secretary.
And so all I can say
there was not conflicting information the day of the attack, because your press secretary said, if pressed, there's no connection between Cairo and Benghazi. It was clear. You're the ones who muddied it up, not the information.
Well, there's no connection.
Here's what I think's going on. Let me show you one more slide. Again, this is from Victoria Nuland, your press person. She says to Jake Sullivan and Philippe Reines, subject line reads this, Romney's statement on Libya. Email says, this is what Ben was talking about. I assume Ben is the now somewhat famous Ben Rhodes, author of the Talking Points memo. This email is at 10:35, 27 minutes after your 10:08 statement. 27 minutes after you've told everyone, it's a video. While Americans are still fighting because the attack's still going on, your top people are talking politics. Seems to me that night you had three options, Secretary. You could tell the truth, like you did with your family, like you did with the Libyan president, like you did with the Egyptian prime minister. Tell them it was a terrorist attack. You could say, you know what, we're not quite sure. Don't really know for sure. I don't think the evidence is there. I think it's all in the first one, but you could have done that. But you picked a third option. You picked the video narrative. You picked the one with no evidence, and you did it because Libya was supposed to be, as Mr. Roskin pointed out, this great success story for the Obama White House and the Clinton State Department. And a key campaign theme that year was GM's alive, Bin Laden's dead, Al-Qaeda's on the run. And now you have a terrorist attack. And it's a terrorist attack in Libya. And it's just 56 days before an election. You can live with a protest about a video. That won't hurt you. But a terrorist attack will. So you can't be square with the American people. You can tell your family it's a terrorist attack, but not the American people. You can tell the president of Libya it's a terrorist attack, but not the American people. And you can tell the Egyptian prime minister it's a terrorist attack, but you can't tell your own people the truth. Madam Secretary, Americans can live with the fact that good people sometimes give their lives for this country. They don't like it. They mourn for those families. They pray for those families. But they can live with it. But what they can't take, what they can't live with, is when their government's not square with them. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Wow, that's incredible. No, this is the impossible truth. We don't want to listen to such a hearing. We don't want to blame anybody. But sometimes you want to know the truth so you can choose. And Mrs. Clinton will work a whole lot of life for America and for the people of America. And the judgment that is not deemed, I guess, by the congressman. So it's not easy. It's not easy. Anyway, the thing about attack, we cannot be soft on terror. Once you're soft on terror, they come stronger. Why don't you all understand it once and for all? It's not about, you know, attacking or hurting or paying back. It's about a stand for your rights. Because once you do that, they are backing off. They'll back off. They'll be afraid or, you know, they need to know that there is somebody in charge. And it's not them. We know it's God, but they need to know that, you know, it gives us the power to stand firm. All right, so let's listen more of, you know, we got a few minutes, and I'm thankful for Doug for allowing me to extend the time so we can talk more about the issue and then that it's so important, especially when the Syrian talk been postponed a little, but they'll be coming soon, okay? So let's listen to what they have there.
On Saturday, after talks with Gulf Cooperation Council states in Saudi Arabia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said he was confident Syrian peace talks would proceed. He told reporters in Riyadh, "We are confident that with good initiative in the next day or so, those talks can get going." The Syria peace talks are planned to begin on January 25th in Geneva. There is uncertainty around the date, however, partly because of a dispute over who will be part of the opposition delegation. Kerry also said there was agreement that immediately after the first round of talks, the International Support Group on Syria would convene.
Okay, so we need to understand that there is so much stuff going on, and right now I got some news that's stating that the French decided to create some kind of regional security conference between Benjamin Netanyahu and the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. So maybe some talks will be in the mix soon. And, you know, it's not easy to create some kind of understanding in the midst of all. And in the midst of all, we got the news that Prince Harry's best friend or one of his explorer friends, Henry Worsley, just died in an attractive track. You know, he was going alone. He was going solo. he was attempting to cross Antarctica alone, solo crossing of Antarctica, 55 years old, ex-Army officer, just, you know, said, so condolences and sympathy for Prince Harry for losing a friend, which probably loves, like he loves everybody else. And we'll go back. Let's go back to what we have to deal with, you know, the issues on end. Let's listen to that.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has held talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Zurich ahead of next week's peace negotiations on Syria. There are serious issues to be resolved before the talks convene, not least which rebel representatives are invited to attend. Russia and Iran, which back Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and Saudi Arabia, other Arab states, and the US and Europe have conflicting ideas on which opposition representatives are acceptable. Hopefully, the talks will start in the near future. We agreed that once the political process has started, we'll be able to talk about a ceasefire. A Syrian opposition council has already threatened to pull out if Russia gets its wish to broaden the opposition negotiating team. There must be a clear environment, there must be a clear agenda for negotiations to work towards a political transition and not to just go and chat and waste time while Syrian people die under the shells and from hunger. This is unacceptable. Russia is impeding the negotiations, so there are no negotiations. As the political process on Syria builds, the defense ministers of seven countries engaged in the fight against ISIL met in Paris to review strategy in the light of repeated terrorist attacks across the globe.
All right. We need to talk. You know, the fact that the oppositions or, you know, the Russian and the Iranian have a problem with one of the position or whoever doesn't mean that you don't need to put them in the room. You need to start moving. And when I say you, whoever is in charge, and I really pray to God that they start, because I know there are movements on the ground to help those in need this winter in the region. Is not easy, and the refugees that are spread all over. God, do you guys understand that there are millions of people on the road and their children, without shelter, and they're running and they're dying and they're starving and they're cold and they're wet and they are miserable? What we are doing, what are we doing? And, you know, in the midst of this, we have other problem, you know, because you cannot separate the good guys from the bad guys. So you get some ISIS all over. Let's listen to what I picked up on that.
From Syria in Germany, claims he spotted a man with ties to the Islamists living there. The former Islamic State hostage recognized a pro-ISIL soldier, who he says stood guard at their town when it was under the control of the terrorists. Peter Oliver has more.
The last time I was here in Germany's Saarland region on the border with France was to meet a group of Syrian Christians who'd been freed after being held hostage by Islamic State.
There were times we prayed that they would just shoot us if it came to that. We prayed that they would not behead us.
But now a stark reminder of their time in captivity has appeared here in Germany.
Those held hostage say that a man with ties to ISIL is living in the same city. One agreed to speak with me on the condition his identity was kept secret.
How can you be sure that the man you identified is the person you think he is?
He stopped me several times at the checkpoint near our village. We were even able to find him on Facebook. I go to the webpage and there's this guy again. I'm convinced that this is the same person I knew in Syria.
So when you first saw him, what was your immediate reaction?
I was very scared that this terrorist is in a democratic state like Germany, just living here. We feel very insecure now. Some of our Assyrian community want to leave this place, as this was not the first case, but we don't know where to run.
Assyrian community leaders say that once they were convinced, they went straight to the police.
Police have taken this very seriously, but we worry that the law cannot back this up with a strong case. They have to wait until this person does something criminal here. But those people were killers in Syria and fly the ISIS flag here even. Such people should have no place in Germany.
Police confirmed that an investigation is underway in this case, but that at the current time, no charges relating to terrorism or any other crime have been brought, which is why we aren't naming or showing any images of the individual being investigated. Last February, Islamic State kidnapped around 250 Assyrian Christians and were demanding ransoms of $100,000 per person. Some have been released, but many remain in captivity.
ISIS came to our village. They devastated our fields, burnt our churches, tore apart our lives. They kidnapped us, murdered us. We have an unbearable feeling of loss.
There's also the fear that ISIL and other jihadist groups are looking to exploit the refugee crisis to enter Europe.
When I was a hostage, I overheard a conversation between my captors. They were saying that the West will belong to us, and we will conquer it through Islamization. One of those that held me was a German who had converted to radical Islam. He was part of this conversation.
Well, as this investigation continues, and with refugees still arriving in Europe, more questions are being asked about just who is coming. From Saarland in Germany for RT, I'm Peter Oliver.
All right. So you understand the situation? Anybody home there? Anybody can listen to the grievance? And when you guys are taking your sweet time, yes, you know, postponing talks, you got them nailed to the 25th. Just be there. And you said maybe postpone 1 day or 2 days. There is no more time to delay. We have no solution for them in, you know, outer world. And there are millions of people that have been displaced. People that took picture from the ground just show so much devastation in Syria, and the building got destroyed. People don't have anywhere to go to and to go back to. But whatever it is, they need to start moving back. And it's time. It's been a while. This war is devastation. They will never forgive. So we need to help them go back home. All right, guys. Let's wrap this session here today, Monday, 25th of January, 2016, with another Songs of Neil Young, with a prayer for the peace in this world and for real, for brotherhood of men, for love and kindness, and just be nice, be you, do your best, but let others be them too. And whoever the bad guys, just God protect us, all right? Let's keep hoping, keep blessing, keep praying that there will be a new time for everybody. So from here to you, with love, happiness, be well, and happy Tu Bishvat to all the Jewish friends. God bless you. God bless you all. Ciao, ciao.